Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today, we focus on the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We have a great faculty, Dr. Jennifer Brown, the director of the CLL Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Dr. Paula Gia from the University Vita Salud San Rafael and the director of the CLL Strategic Program, the IRCCS OPSTYLE San Rafael, Milano, Italy. And sorry, Paulo, I know I didn't get the pronunciation perfect, but I'll work on it. Today, we're here to talk about CLL, what's been going on in the past year. And as we do in all of our programs, we just mentioned the fact that we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. So check out the official prescribing information for more information. As we do in all of our year in review programs, I've met with the faculty in the last couple of weeks to record a presentation, reviewing many, many papers and presentations over the past year. These are actually in the chat room, and we're going to send it out with this recording of this program tonight as well. So this is really a three-part program, and you know, the two presentations, which are both excellent, really interesting content. They go through in detail a lot of papers. Here are the papers that they review. So to get into the data specifically and you know, ups and positives with all these papers, check that out. But what we're here to do today is I picked out a few of the slides from the presentation for further discussion, particularly in terms of clinical implications, so I can get both of the faculty's point of view and also research implications in terms of where we're heading. So we're going to start out talking about BTK inhibitors, then venetoclax, and then, of course, one of the biggest stories in the history of CLL, the Amplify presentation that Jennifer did at the ASH meeting, but other combinations. Then we'll talk about pirtobrutinib, we'll finish out with CAR-T and other novel agents. But I just want to sort of take a breath for a second before we get started. And this is a question that was kind of in my mind last night, Jennifer. I know you started the CLL Center at Dana-Farber in 2007, after you got there in 2004, and the place is really an outstanding center now for research and patient care. But what I was curious about is, this is kind of like my view of CLL from our perspective, you know, research to practice. So first of all, just to mention the fact that a quarter to a third of our audience has been in oncology less than 10 years. So when they came into oncology, ibrutinib was already here. But for everybody else, you know, there was a long history, of course, with chemoimmunotherapy, BR, FCR, even rituximab alone. Then 2013, ibrutinib was approved, 17, acalabrutinib, 23, zanubrutinib. In the middle of it, 2020, the pandemic started. And, you know, I always think about CLL when I think about webinars, because the pandemic sort of hit at the same time that CLL was really exploding. The whole issue of, you know, choice, which we still have today, choice of first-line therapy. We did a lot of webinars. We presented a lot of cases, you know, the issues about the pandemic, et cetera. And then more recently, we had pirtobrutinib approved in 23, CAR-T therapy with liso-cel in 24, and then in December, the Amplify data. And Jennifer, the question we actually asked the audience, I'm going to tell you in a second what they said, but I'm curious. I was kind of like thinking about this and trying to think about, like, you know, what have we really accomplished? I mean, obviously the science of CLL has exploded. It's just amazing how much stuff we have to talk about. But I was kind of curious from a patient point of view, particularly for these people new to oncology who don't know the world before ibrutinib, Jennifer, kind of, let's say, the face of CLL before novel therapy, before 2013, in terms of what patients experience, what their survival was. The question we asked was, is the survival significantly longer? If it's not, or even if it is, what about quality of life? Is that better for patients? You know, in terms of survival, I'm not exactly sure how many people actually die of CLL. A lot of people die of transformation, but I'm not sure that's different now than it was in 2013, so I'll be curious what you think about that question. I would think that, you know, morbidity would be less without all these novel strategies, but again, particularly once you get beyond first-line therapy, Jennifer, I was actually flashing one of the earlier patients we presented after the pandemic came in, was a patient who actually had previously been diagnosed with CLL. And in order to, the patient had read about ibrutinib, the only way he could get ibrutinib was to go on a trial. So he went on a trial of FCR versus ibrutinib, the well-known, I think it was an intergroup study, and he got randomized to FCR, and he got cured. I mean, he has no more disease, but he's had all kinds of problems from the FCR. It was like he got cured by mistake because he really wanted ibrutinib. But I'm just kind of curious, before we start getting into what happened in the past year, just to reflect back on what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, Jennifer, as you've seen it, people going through the CLL Center, what's your take on what we've done in terms of improving quality of life and duration of life, survival?
I think we've improved both quality and duration of life, at least for the approximately half of CLL patients who have the more aggressive disease and maybe even some of the others. And, you know, nowadays it's hard for people to remember. We had patients with huge lymph nodes, bulky lymph nodes, poking out 8-10 centimeters in their armpits and their necks, groin, that we couldn't shrink after their first or second round of therapy. And, you know, that doesn't happen anymore, hardly at all. And I think transformation is actually less too, probably because we have longer duration of a benefit from therapy and more effective therapy. Certainly in the randomized trials, we haven't seen a lot of transformation, even in 5 and 6 year follow-up. So that's encouraging.
That's really interesting. That's the first time I've heard anybody say they thought transformation was less frequent. So, Paulo, any thoughts again now versus 15 years ago, the CLL experience?
Thank you for the question, because we just published a manuscript where we are revising the past 10 years. And we show that in the era of ibrutinib, of continuous treatment with BTK inhibitors, patients indeed now have a life expectancy that is superimposable to that of age-matched healthy individuals. So I think that's the biggest accomplishment in the past 10 years in the era of novel therapies, because not only in frontline we have very effective treatment, but we can also rescue them at later stages and lines. So I think this is now is the ground on which we have to improve and get to a final cure.
So that's the second thing I was going to ask, is kind of what your thoughts are about the next 10 years or so, Jennifer, where you see overall the treatment strategy heading, where you see MRD, do you see that's going to become a part of sort of daily practice, for example?
I think we're definitely moving toward time-limited combination therapy and deeper remissions, so patients can have breaks off treatment. And MRD-guided approaches will hopefully become more common. It's hard to incorporate continuous MRD guidance, but we have trials that are looking at, for example, 1 or 2 evaluation time points in terms of duration of therapy. And so it'll be interesting to see if that provides benefit compared to a fixed duration. I'm also very interested in the potential for using immune therapies as consolidation or even in combination to potentially really deepen response and maybe get us that last bit toward cure.
So actually, I was going to say our audience, the most common answer they gave was that they felt like both survival and quality of life were improved. The rest were split between one versus the other. Again, Paulo, any thoughts about where we're heading and what CLL is going to look like in 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I definitely think that MRD assessment will become part of any clinical trials in the future, because hopefully it will be also become an intermediate endpoint for clinical trials, so that we can speed up the approval of new drugs. In the general practice, it really depends on the results, on how feasible and easy it may become to assess MRD. And in particular, we have probably many years in front of us before we will know exactly what to do based on the MRD value that we obtain in our patients.
All right, well, let's start getting into some of the papers that came out this past year and what they mean. We're going to go back and forth between things that each one of you presented, and we're going to start out talking about BTK inhibitors, because we want both of your thoughts on this. These are some of the related papers that we talked about. And Paula, maybe you can comment a little bit on this paper, CLL12. You know, a question, we get a lot of questions about this issue of people 17P, high risk, who don't really fit the criteria for treatment. Can you talk about what this trial looked at, what they saw, and what you think it means to docs in practice?
So this is a typical trial that comes every probably 10 years where we really don't believe somehow that we can wait until progression before starting treatment. So we want to try early approaches, early treatment, and that's what has been explored in the CLL12 study by the German colleagues, ibrutinib versus observation in patients with high-risk disease. So what we learned from this is definitely, even with ibrutinib, even with a BTK inhibitor, still we don't see any advantage in terms, not in terms of progression-free survival, which is, of course, short and prolonged if you start early the therapy, but in terms of PFS2, so the second, the need of the second treatment, and in particular in terms of overall survival. But with what we learn again very clearly is that what we have still to understand how to identify really the patient who will suffer the most from CLL, from the leukemia. Because in this study, again, they were selected based on the knowledge at that time, which is several years back, and still some of these patients did not progress or did not need treatment, if not after many, many years in the control arm. So that's where we have to refine our knowledge.
So, Jennifer, I beg your pardon for saying this, but I have to say things that come into my mind and talking to people in all kinds of oncology. In a weird kind of way, it makes me think a little bit about smoldering myeloma. You know, we work with your myeloma colleagues all the time on CME, and we see initially there wasn't much happening, and now you see them talking about treating people who in the past they would never treat, attempting to cure. And you brought up the possibility of immunotherapy or cure. Do you think there's going to become a time that we will be treating people who today were, you know, saying, oh, you can be observed, a subset of these patients? And do you think there's the hope that maybe treating earlier theoretically might potentially lead to greater long-term better outcomes?
Well, I think we still have no evidence for that. CLL is a more indolent disease. And as Paolo said, it is hard to figure out who's going to have the most rapid progression and the worst potential outcome. And until we understand that, we don't even really know who to target the trials to. We also have to reduce the morbidity of the potential treatments. We know that a lot of clonal evolution, worsening of the disease, does happen under the influence of treatment. And so that potentially is accelerated by earlier treatment. And that's a concern, I think, that we need to be cognizant of when we're potentially studying this. For now, there's no indication for early treatment.
Well, you know, as they say, the lack of evidence is not evidence of a lack, but whatever. Maybe we just need to find the right patients, or maybe not two, as you were saying. So again, I just picked out some of the papers you all went through, and not so much to review all the details, but get more of the bottom line. And Paolo, you talked about this, I don't know if you call it a pooled analysis, not a meta-analysis, but a pooled analysis of a number of trials looking at acalabrutinib, trying to get more strength in terms of efficacy as well as tolerability. Any sort of broad conclusions you have looking at acalabrutinib, and we'll talk a little bit off, of course, about zanubrutinib as well. But in terms of this paper, any thoughts? What was your takeaway from this, Paolo?
Yeah, this was a reassuring paper, as I would say, meaning that by pulling data from many different trials in frontline and in relapsed refractory setting, then we just confirmed actually the initial impression of about acalabrutinib, the second generation BTK inhibitor, and so we confirmed that this is a better tolerated drug, and that is also very effective in the long run in all categories and subsets of patients, including patients with deletion 17p or p53 mutations and patients with unmutated immunoglobulin genes. And again, what is also we learned already in the past years also with the other BTK inhibitors is that the if you use it in earlier lines, of course, the progression-free survival and the control of the disease will be more prolonged than if you start using in second, third, or even more advanced lines of therapy.
So, Jennifer, I'm also curious. Paulo talked about another paper from the ASH meeting. I'm always curious about this issue in all cancers, the very elderly and particularly frail elderly patients. This was a study looking at acalabrutinib in elderly patients. Any comments on this data and also your clinical experience and your approach to older patients? You know, it's interesting, too, looking at what happened to these patients in terms of their frailty once they started on treatment, in this case, acalabrutinib. Any comments about how you think through the very elderly? We have a case tomorrow of a 98-year-old as we're going to present, but that's getting very extreme there. But anything you want to say about this paper and your thoughts about the frail elderly, Jennifer?
I think it does underscore that with the advent of the second generation and later generation BTK inhibitors, there is almost not really a patient who I wouldn't consider treating if they really needed treatment for their CLL. My experience has been that with acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, one can actually use them successfully, even in the somewhat frail elderly patients. And so that is actually revolutionary compared to before. And it's also very easy to give these drugs typically. The monitoring and visits to the clinic are not as great, and that makes it feasible.
So I want to bring up another paper. And a lot of times we bring up these papers to alert the audience that these are really good papers to read, and this is one of them. This is a review of a topic we've talked about many times in the last few years, BTK-related cardiovascular toxicity. I mean, I actually have this paper right here printed out. It's, you know, like 10 pages, very comprehensive. Paula went through a lot of the details of it. But I just want to use this as a way to sort of get into some of the issues and how you think about them. I want to start out, Paula, with the issue of bleeding. How do you approach the patient who's already on anticoagulation? Based on the type of anticoagulation, the number of scenario, any comments about the issue of bleeding with BTK inhibitors and also the difference between first, second, and third generation BTKIs?
Yes, I would like to give one first general message, which is what we learn and what is also suggested strongly in this paper, is that we have to do a thorough cardiovascular assessment in all our patients before starting BTK inhibitors. And I would even say without starting any therapy in CLL, because most of our patients are old, they have comorbidity, they have cardiac comorbidity. So we want to be aware, fully informed of their baseline situation so that whatever happens during the therapy, we are ready to intervene. Having said that, the bleeding is one of the most common, in particular minor bleeding, fortunately. Minor bleeding is probably one of the most frequent adverse events that patients complain under BTKI. There is an advantage in particular with acalabrutinib in terms of minor bleeding, which is decreased compared to ibrutinib, for example, something that we didn't see exactly with zanubrutinib compared to ibrutinib. And it's something that you have to keep in mind. And whenever the patient needs to start anticoagulation, like for example, when developing an atrial fibrillation, still we start anticoagulation as in any other individuals, and then we try to probably play with the dose based on what happens to the patient. And nowadays we know that we can play either with dose of the anticoagulant or also, for example, in the case of ibrutinib, or the dose of the BTKI, so to find the right balance in each patient.
So, Jennifer, I was mentioning to you that everything we do at RTP is based on rounds. So if any sort of clinical pearls you have that you want to add to what Paulo just said about bleeding, but also interested in your comments on atrial fibrillation, Obviously, the issue of what do you do when somebody develops atrial fibrillation or BTK inhibitor, but also even more challenging, I think, is the patient who has already had atrial fibrillation, how you think through them through in terms of potential BTK. A lot of people avoid it, and yet others maybe don't.
Right. Well, just to remind people, in terms of the bleeding, we really don't use warfarin anticoagulation concomitant with BTK inhibitors. Most commonly use DOACs. One can also use Lovenox. There are data for that. And I also do worry about dual antiplatelet therapy with clopidogrel as well as aspirin, for example. Although we're getting a little bit more experience, but that's essentially three antiplatelet drugs, and so be very cautious there. You know, with respect to the atrial fibrillation, I think we've gotten pretty comfortable managing it. If a patient is well controlled with their chronic atrial fibrillation and they're on, say, a DOAC, I don't really worry too much about using a second generation BTKI. They tend to stay stable, and, you know, we just are a little bit more careful about evaluating any bleeding or bruising risk. And patients who do develop atrial fibrillation, sometimes it's an incidental finding in the office, and they're not even really symptomatic. So those patients, I don't even really stop the BTK. I just, if they need some rate control, I start that, and I start some anticoagulation, and usually continue. Now, patients who have a more acute presentation, I will usually hold the BTK until we get control of the rhythm, hopefully the rhythm, at least the rate, and start anticoagulation. But it will usually re-challenge as once people are controlled. And most patients were able to continue and just manage through the atrial fibrillation.
So, Paulo, anything you want to add to that in terms of atrial fibrillation? But I also want to bring up another issue brought up in this paper, ventricular arrhythmias. Not too often that you see potentially grade 5 toxicity from a treatment in CLL, but you can obviously die from ventricular arrhythmias. I heard about cases on people on ibrutinib. I'm not sure exactly what we know about the second generation Acala and Zanu in terms of ventricular arrhythmias. I'm curious what your thoughts are, Paulo. And do you bring this up to a patient? I mean, it's a pretty scary side effect to bring up to a patient. I'm curious if you bring that up.
Yeah, first thing on atrial fibrillation, I mean, as my cardiologist taught me, is really when they already have atrial fibrillation, nothing worse can happen. I mean, it's not that it gets worse. So this is definitely not a contraindication for starting a BTK inhibitor in case you believe that's the best therapy for your patient. In terms of ventricular arrhythmia, again, it has been reported, though fortunately very, very, very rare, in particular with ibrutinib, first generation BTK inhibitor, and that's why many doctors are then tending to use second generation BTK inhibitors, where there has been a number of studies that, of course, you have less follow-up, so the situation is less clear, but we have also to distinguish between the possibility of ventricular arrhythmias and the fatal outcome, which is definitely much rarer. It's something that we may discuss with our patient, but again, it's very, very often is associated to a pre-existing cardiac situation also, that, again, which leads us to the concept that I said before, where we should really do a thorough cardiologic workup before starting, so that if there is anything that is not really convincing you from a cardiovascular point of view, then you might choose another therapy. But of course, it's a risk that may happen, and we cannot do much against that. But it's definitely very rare. I don't remember in my practice seeing one.
So we could spend a whole hour just talking about this topic. And just one other question, and you see, Jennifer, there, the topic of hypertension. I'm curious how closely you follow blood pressure in your patients. Do you have, if they start out normotensive, do you have them check their blood pressure? Do you have any preferences? Hypertension, for example, difficult to control hypertension, make you sway in your decision about which BTK inhibitor to use? And do you think hypertension might in some way contribute to atrial fibrillation?
Right. So in terms of hypertension, we do discuss it with patients. It tends to be a longer term side effect rather than, say, the first few weeks. So usually don't talk to them too much about it when they're first starting, but we monitor them in clinic, which, you know, we see them a few times in the first 3 months and then usually every 3 months. So we do pay attention in clinic. And if there's any signs of it going up, then we can get them starting to monitor it once they're kind of settled on therapy. You know, in looking at the trial data, clearly with acalabrutinib, hypertension is reduced compared to ibrutinib. The head-to-head trial for zanubrutinib had fairly comparable rates of hypertension between zanubrutinib and ibrutinib, although the degree of increase with zanubrutinib was less than ibrutinib. I have to say, in my practice, I don't feel like I've really noticed this difference between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, and so I haven't tended to make decisions about which drug to use based on that. I consider it a fairly significant class effect over time.
So, and here's some great clues, a great graphic from this paper. There's a lot of great, there's a really cool algorithm I'm not going to get into today, but it's a great paper to read. Paulo, any other final comments about this topic?
No, as Jennifer properly said, the occurrence of hypertension or the worsening of hypertension occurs late from the start of the therapy. So it's something that is then even difficult to understand how much is due to the drug and due instead to the aging of the patient that remains on therapy. So it's anyhow, we are checking the blood pressure. Patients are checking the blood pressure because they are, most of them are already old. So it's something that we do, but it's definitely we mention about it because we will do the check, but it's not something that is really driving my decision in any way. It's definitely something we don't put so much weight on.
So a couple of words about venetoclax. I have to say, as soon as I saw the abstract for the AMPLIFY trial came out, I was like, really, couldn't wait to do this program. And I'm really looking for, I already have so many questions in the chat room about AMPLIFY. They're like chomping at the bit, but instructive also to look at what's going on with venetoclax or venetoclax obinutuzumab, because in terms of time-limited therapy, of course, this is the current option that people are turning to. And Paulo, you talked about the long-term or longer-term 6-year follow-up on the CLL14 study of venetoclax obinutuzumab. Anything you want to comment on there? I was talking before about the patient who was cured with FCR, and I'm curious whether or not either in these venetoclax trials or ibrutinib trials, we're seeing anything that looks like a plateau on the curve.
Yeah. So that's the point, in fact. I mean, besides all the good news that we learned from the CLL14 study, that study that compared venetoclax plus obinutuzumab to chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab, we all were looking forward to see long-term follow-up in order to see a plateau. And now after 6 years, in particular for the patient with mutated immunoglobulin genes, and unfortunately we don't, which is the plot in the middle, we don't see that. So this is somehow, let's say, disappointing. But of course, it's a completely different mechanism compared to immunochemotherapy. These are treatments that can be given again, so that a completely different story. So even if we don't reach a plateau, we can always retreat the patient with a venetoclax-based treatment. So this is not worrying us at all. Of course, the VNOB somehow paved the way to fixed duration treatment. And in particular, we learned that how good it could be to have an all-oral therapy, as we will see with the BTKI plus venetoclax combination, rather than to have the issue of infusion with obinutuzumab, the infusion reaction and so on. We also learned that with VNOB, in particular patient with unmutated immunoglobulin genes, and definitely patients with P53 aberrations are not probably benefiting the most from this therapy.
Jennifer, any other comments you want to add to the issue of venetoclax obinutuzumab?
Well, I'll just comment on this slide that clearly the patients with undetectable MRD do better than the ones with detectable MRD, but underscoring this issue that we're not seeing a plateau or potential cure, less than 10% of patients still had undetectable MRD at the 5 to 6 year follow-up. So we are seeing this steady recurrence, but we can use it again.
I was mentioning that we're doing this program at AUA on AKT inhibitors, and I was talking to Dan George from Duke, who's going to be the moderator for that. And he was saying, I was telling him we were having this, we're telling him about the Amplified trial and the fact that we're doing this thing. And he was saying, it kind of reminds me a little bit of prostate cancer where they're doing intermittent therapy. You know, they treat with intensive hormonal therapy and then stop and see what happens. And maybe someday, you know, you get a long disease-free interval when you use Venobi. Maybe, you know, you have some kind of sequential strategy in the future. And also, just one other issue I was just kind of curious about, which is, this is a paper from The Lancet, but also something I've heard about, you know, on and off over the years, which is venetoclax without anti-CD20, Paulo. What do we know about the efficacy and tolerability of venetoclax by itself?
Oh, that remains actually one of the unsolved mystery of CLL, and we remain like that because in the relapsed refractory setting, the investigators switch almost immediately from venetoclax alone to fixed duration, venetoclax plus cetuximab, and so on and so forth, in combination treatment. So we are really missing data. The general impression, and also in the Venice one trial, is that monotherapy is the continuous therapy with venetoclax monotherapy is not like a continuous therapy with BTKI. So the BTKI has a rationale in using it continuously, also because we don't achieve deep responses. With venetoclax, it's really probably stratifying patient based on those who have very nice and deep responses, even achieving undetectable MRD, even with the monotherapy, and those who can even remain for a long time on the therapy, but then they will not benefit as long as you might expect from a continuous treatment with BTKI.
So I want to get into Amplify, but anything, Jennifer, you want to say about venetoclax monotherapy? Any situations in your practice outside of trial where you use venetoclax by itself?
Not anymore. I always use an antibody, almost always obinutuzumab, since we know it's better than rituximab from other data, comparative data.
So that leads into the discussion of the Amplify trial, and I'm going to ask Jennifer to talk about, and these are the papers that on Amplify as well as other related papers. But before we get into the actual Amplify data, just to take a step back, and we'll get into this in a second, Jennifer, but we've had a couple of questions in the chat room about the issue of COVID deaths that occur. And that's, when I saw that abstract, that was the first thing that got my attention, because I guess you did the a lot of the patients on the Amplify trial went on during the pandemic before the vaccine was, and you had quite a few deaths there. Now that we've sort of at least gotten past that stage of the COVID, when you put it all together, Jennifer, what's your take on COVID and CLL, anti-CD20? How concerned are you? What was going on when you had all these deaths? Were they mostly unvaccinated patients?
Yeah, so not only were patients going on early in the pandemic, they were actually, many of them, 75% of patients had started treatment and were actively on treatment when the pandemic started before the vaccines were available. The deaths were almost entirely in unvaccinated patients. And it was the early era of COVID when the strain was more aggressive. You know, I think we've seen an evolution on several levels. This includes that now we have repeated vaccination, which even in many patients who don't respond initially, we can start to see some response to vaccine after repeated vaccination. We also have probably weakening of the strains and general herd immunity. And so I think it's become much less of an issue than it was. Amplify does, I think, underscore that the CD20 antibody is a critical component in the COVID risk because we saw the deaths primarily in the arms with the antibody. But I do think nowadays it's manageable and it's a trade-off that one has to consider in the context of any specific patient. We also actually in patients on long-term BTK inhibitors still see difficulty with clearing COVID where we sometimes have to do prolonged or extra courses of Paxlovid or Remdesivir. And so particularly those two populations, people with current CD20 or on long-term ongoing BTK inhibitors, I still worry about COVID. But, you know, we're not really worrying about death anymore. These patients aren't even in the hospital, most of them, when we're giving them their prolonged courses to get over. They just have an upper respiratory tract infection or bronchitis.
So that's interesting you bring up BTK inhibitors. As I remember, at one point early in the pandemic, people were talking about BTK inhibitors to treat COVID. There was, you know, I was all excited about it. I thought maybe, you know, because of course at that point everybody was panicked in general before the vaccine came out. Paulo, anything you want to add to this discussion before we get into the Amplify data about COVID, CLL, and anti-CD20 antibodies nowadays?
Yeah, more than, I mean, I fully share what Jennifer said, so COVID is probably not a priority anymore. It's just, I think it's a lesson learned, meaning that as we also seen in the Gaia study, CLL13, where there was the triplet ibrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, also there was an increase in infections in general. So that's probably what we have to keep in mind without being again scared of any drugs. I mean, we have to know the drugs and know how to use them. But we have to be aware definitely that whenever you add an anti-CD20 antibody, you add an increased risk of infection in general, probably viral. Also because we learned during the pandemic, and thanks to COVID, that the antibody at the end of the day lasts for up to 12 months, not shorter as we thought before. So the immunosuppression can really last for long. And again, it can interfere also with vaccination. So one has really to plan. As Jennifer mentioned, vaccination is fundamental. We have to vaccinate our patient definitely before starting therapy. I always say even a diagnosis already. So when the immune system is at the highest.
I agree with that. I wanted to mention that in the Amplify data we actually published before the unblinding, that patients who are vaccinated during therapy at a time when people think they're getting treatments that are going to inhibit the response had a better survival. So even if you should get them at diagnosis, you should get them before therapy, but if you don't, you should still vaccinate them on treatment because in Amplify we saw a benefit.
Yeah.
That's a really good, great point. All right, let's talk about Amplify. And, you know, I was mentioning we don't use a lot of slides here because a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, you know, while they're shoveling snow or raking the leaves or whatever. But Jennifer, can you just describe the design of the Amplify study and specifically, particularly for the AVO arm, exactly when people get treated, what patients go through?
Right, exactly. So this, of course, is a phase 3 randomized trial, registrational, in fit CLL patients without 17p deletion, who were randomized between acalabrutinib-venetoclax, acalabrutinib-venetoclax-obinutuzumab, or chemoimmunotherapy, where FCR was restricted to people with adequate renal function under 65 years of age, and BR was given to fit patients who are older or with lesser renal function. The primary endpoint compared AV to chemoimmunotherapy, and then the next first secondary endpoint was AVO to chemoimmunotherapy. And so both of those were highly positive for progression-free survival, favoring AV and AVO. Now, the AVO regimen, so both AV and AVO start with a month of acalabrutinib first. And then on the AVO arm, obinutuzumab comes in at month 2. And according to the package insert and the way we give it in VenOpen, you do days 1 and 2, day 8 and 15 in month 2. Then they get a week off. And then in month 3, they start their venetoclax ramp up again, according to the package insert. And the patients on the AV arm just do the 2 months of A and then do the venetoclax in month 3. And then, so then the obinutuzumab will continue with the monthly infusions for the 5 additional doses. And the AV together after the venetoclax ramp up will continue together to complete 14 months. And so it's a little bit intensive in months 2 and 3 for the patients, but then it gets easier with monthly infusions. And then once those are done, just with the 2 oral drugs.
So before you get into more about the results, Paulo, any comments about what happens to these patients as they go through this process? And particularly, one of the things we see with Venobi is that by the time the patient gets the venetoclax, they're often debulked. And so the risk for TLS is decreased. Do you see debulking with the BTK, with the acalabrutinib, and then by the time they get to the obin, are they less bulky, or what actually happens?
No, that's the point, and that's the whole rationale behind the design of the treatment, because again, with a couple of months of BTKI, we all know how effective they are in debulking patient, in bringing again patient probably to normal level or almost normal level of hemoglobin, but definitely the lymph nodes are can almost disappear. So beside the decrease in the tumor lysis syndrome risk when you add venetoclax, it's really the fact that you have immediate control of the disease, like it is typical of a BTKI. And so when you get to venetoclax, you feel, the patient and the doctor feel much more relaxed. Let's say you have already controlled the disease, and then you can now improve the quality of the response.
Anything else you want to say, Jennifer, about the data, both efficacy? You note here the fact it looks like they had good outcomes, whether they're mutated or not. Anything else you want to say about tolerability? And in particular, of course, the question everyone wants to know is, do you think this is a good option for patients? And if so, which patients would you be thinking about AV, and what patients do you think about AVO? As always, people bring up young, fit, higher risk patients. I wonder too about older, fit, higher risk patients. But from a clinical point of view, where do you know? Is, we went through again when once the BTK was out there, Venobi, 3-4 years, people are trying to sort out how you present it to patients. What kind of patient like this? What kind of patient looks like this? Hopefully now we're going to have another really different option on the table here, particularly because all oral. A lot of people aren't huge fans of the obinutuzumab and the experience people have receiving it. Jennifer, how do you see this settling out in clinical practice? Do you think you could use another BTK inhibitor instead of acalazanu, for example, with this? Of course, we'll talk. You talked in your talk about all the trials looking at zanu. Any thoughts?
Well, so there's no planned comparison in Amplify between the AV and the AVO. But it does, as we saw in the PFS curves, look like the AVO is achieving a longer 3-year PFS at 83%. The AV is 76%. And this also correlates with the rates of undetectable MRD, which were very high on the AVO arm. And we're about 40-ish percent on the AV arm, which is not dissimilar from other BTK-BCL2 combinations. I think the AV arm was really very well tolerated. There was only a 10% rate of grade 3 infections, which is lower than almost any of our other therapies in trials that we've seen. And again, it's all oral. In the mutated patients, essentially AV and AVO were doing pretty equivalently at 3 years. And so especially for the lower to intermediate risk patients, that's a very easy and safe option. The AVO was still very well tolerated. There was very little cardiac or hypertension toxicity on this trial on either acalabrutinib-containing arm, possibly because it's only 14 months of therapy. But that was very reassuring. But there were more infections in particular on the AVO arm and somewhat more neutropenia. And so that's where one just has to balance that somewhat increased infection risk versus the fact that there was an extremely high rate of undetectable MRD. If you actually censor for COVID, the 3-year PFS is 91% in the AVO arm. And also in the AVO arm, we saw that the unmutated patients did as well as the mutated patients at 3 years. So you're really reversing that worsened outcome that we see in the unmutated patients with the obinutuzumab. And so it seemed like really the unmutated patients, as well as the 17p deleted patients, which we saw in the parallel trial that we did at Dana-Farber, led by my colleague Matt Davids, seemed to benefit in particular from the obinutuzumab. And you asked about older patients as well as younger fit patients. I think I'd be perfectly comfortable doing the 3-drug regimen for older patients, especially if they had bad disease, as long as they were reasonably fit.
Yeah, I skipped through that paper that you all had with AVO, but that when DEL-17P, obviously very important. Also, you presented a bunch of trials looking at zanubrutinib with venetoclax, as well as with a new BCL-2 inhibitor, sonrotoclax. So hopefully we're likely going to be seeing data there. They're going to have to end up indirectly comparing to the AMPLIFY trial. Again, Paulo, any comments on where you see the AMPLIFY strategy fitting in today? If you could use anything you wanted to use, how would you integrate this data into your practice? Can you describe a patient where you wouldn't use either AV or AVO?
No, actually, in Europe, we have the luck that we already started using the combination between ibrutinib and venetoclax. So, and what we realize is, again, it's so easy to use an all-oral combination, then it's easy to switch from any other treatment to this one in particular, because I think the future will be fixed duration. So now the way how we think when we see any patient who needs a treatment is, why not fixed duration? So fixed duration is the first option. And then the fact that it's all oral, and in particular having acalabrutinib is also well tolerated in the elderly patient, it makes probably the combination the first option to propose to the patient. And then based on maybe patient preferences, then you can discuss other treatment. I agree fully with Jennifer that the option of AVO is something that instead you have to consider in particular subgroup of patients where you want to be more effective, you have to want to have a longer control of the disease. But of course, you have to balance that out with a higher risk of infection.
Yeah, I know when the data first came out, people were saying, well, for those patients who would like a limited duration treatment and all oral regimen, I'm like, well, who wouldn't want that, you know, theoretically, assuming you get the same long-term outcome. Let's talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib as well. I mean, we talk about the future, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be including pirtobrutinib. And Jennifer, it already is here, so to speak. Well, we saw this paper at the ASH meeting comparing pirtobrutinib to adalimumab R or BR, which, interestingly, it looked like it had pretty decent. I mean, it wasn't as effective as pirtobrutinib by far, but it still had some efficacy. Any thoughts about these data, Jennifer, and kind of what it means to clinical practice?
Well, so this is the first randomized trial with pirtobrutinib, also the first randomized trial in patients who have all been exposed to covalent BTK inhibitor beforehand. And so in that sense, it's a novel population that we're not used to looking at. And so I think that that's why some of the efficacy overall may be a little less than we thought, but pirtobrutinib had a PFS of about 14 months. And then in terms of the data here, which is time to next treatment or death in patients who are venetoclax naive, it's 30 months. In venetoclax treated, it's 20 months. And so this is very encouraging. Pirtobrutinib is really our go-to in the patients who have progressed on covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, because it's very easy to give, very well-tolerated BTK inhibitor. And as you noted, I think we also learned from this trial that adalimumab rituximab also has activity in this patient population with about a year of benefit. And so that's also an option that we can use in these patients who at this point have fewer options.
So, Paulo, it's been a while since we talked about adalimumab and CLL, but here it is, and you know, looking pretty good. Anything you want to say about that? Also pirtobrutinib, and also tolerability issues with adalimumab, if any?
No, of course. I mean, I was involved in the design of the BRUIN 3-2-1 study, and in fact, the design was with idelalisib plus cetuximab as a control arm, plus or bendamustine plus cetuximab, because in Europe we were still using at that time as third line therapy idelalisib plus cetuximab, and I have to say that the PFS that you see now, 9 months, between 7 and 9 months, depending on the subgroup, is exactly what we learned and we knew already by using it in real world setting, meaning that when you fail a BTKI and venetoclax, you can still rescue the patient. So it was no surprise for us. And therefore, we enrolled very well in the study because it was very ethical from us. It was the real control that we would use in general practice. And therefore, we are somehow reassured by the fact, as underscored by Jennifer, that at the end of the day, time to next treatment, which is the most relevant parameter for a clinician, is really around 2 years. And that's exactly what the experience that we had in the study. So because it's not progression, because at the end, you keep the patient on pirtobrutinib, even if the patient starts progressing, like we do with all BTK inhibitors. So we keep on treating the patient. We still have a benefit that is prolonged up to 2 years. So that, I think, is a very good option. It's not the final solution, of course, but it's definitely giving us another couple of years where we can do something for our patients.
So, Jennifer, it's always a challenge in oncology. I feel like no matter what tumor type we're talking about, this comes up of indirect comparison of agents that are very similar class of agents, but yet you don't have any data directly comparing them. You know, you hear people talk about pirtobrutinib looking like maybe it's even, you know, clearly maybe going to be safer than ibrutinib, just like a Cala and Zanu, but maybe even safer than a Cala or Zanu. I'm curious, Jennifer, what you think you would see if there was a trial that will never happen, a three-arm randomized trial of monotherapy of a Cala versus Zanu versus pirtobrutinib in terms of efficacy, but particularly in terms of tolerability. You think you could see a difference between Perto and Zanu and Acala in terms of tolerability?
I think it's possible. My impression is that the cardiac side effects of Perto are more limited. The more recent data with Perto has actually shown a pretty high rate of infection, as we would expect in these heavily pretreated sick patients, which looks pretty comparable to Acala and Zanu, and also a little bit more bleeding than had been seen in the phase one. And so that may be similar, but it still seems like, and also thinking of my clinical practice, that cardiac toxicity may be less. I'm not sure I'm going to take on that question of efficacy. It's really hard to know. We don't really have any proper data to, it turns out that it seems like an indirect comparison. You can make either Acala or Zanu win depending on how you set your parameters. So that's not completely fair. And I would not yet consider moving Perto before them because we don't have any long-term follow-up. You know, we have 7, 8, 9 year follow-up with the covalent BTK inhibitors showing how efficacious they are. And pirtobrutinib, we just don't have that. We only have a couple of years. And we don't fully understand what the resistance profile, if used in earlier line, would be. And so trials are ongoing assessing pirtobrutinib in earlier line, and we'll be certainly interested to see the outcome of those as well as the long-term follow-up of those. But for now, I think it's premature for practice, for sure.
Polo, anything you want to add to that? And also, if you have a patient who's not eligible for CAR-T who progresses on pirtobrutinib, do you see responses to Adela in a patient like that? Or would you use Adela in a patient like that?
So now the first thing I wanted to say is that indeed we will have a direct comparison because there is a phase 3 study comparing pirto to ibrutinib. So somehow we will be able to compare to have some data, direct data. In terms of use of Adela after pirtobrutinib, I have to say that we never tried it because in Italy and in Europe, we had the possibility to use pirto in a compassionate use only after being exposed also to idelalisib, so what we call penta-refractory. So we don't have that experience.
So I'm starting to sound a little bit like ibrutinib is the new chlorambucil. You know, you put these new BTK inhibitors because you know they're going to beat them up, but you don't look at the second line. But also curious about the issue of Perto in transform disease, Jennifer, if you could comment on that. And also your strategy in a younger patient with double refractory disease. Are you thinking about pirtobrutinib as a bridge to CAR-T, for example? Where do you think bispecifics are going to fit in?
Right. So in terms of younger patients with double refractory disease, my first goal is to prevent them from becoming double refractory. And some of that is by time-limited options where we stop and then hopefully they progress much later and we can reuse the drugs. Also, we've had a strategy of always using clinical trials intermixed and potentially saving standard regimens later if we have an available trial at the time. And I would say Pirto as a bridge to CAR T would probably be a good approach in those patients who've reached that point. It actually hasn't come up for me real recently since the CAR T approval, but that's probably what I would do. And then in terms of Pirto in transformed disease, we have a large prospective cohort of the phase one Bruin trial that looked at Pirto and Richter's transformation. The response rate was about 50%, which is actually really pretty good in a large population, but the PFS is still a little bit short, as it is with so many of our single agents. And so I think it's a good backbone to potentially build or try combinations on in Richter's. And then regarding bispecifics, so that would be another option to mix in there after double refractory patients. And at the moment, I would probably consider trying it before CAR. It's sort of a conversation with the patient. But just because CAR, as it is, only has about a 20% complete remission rate. And those are the patients who have the most benefit. For the others, it's only about a 2-year benefit, 2.5-year benefit, which is not that different than Pirto or the other options we're talking about. We, of course, we don't know what the benefit is with bispecifics, but it's sort of a little analogous to adding in drugs from clinical trials and saving what's available till later.
Any final comments on the double refractory patient, Paulo? Also, we reviewed papers I was mentioning looking at venetoclax combinations with pirtobrutinib, and there are a number of trials that are being looked at. It looks very promising in terms of MRD, et cetera. Where do you see that heading? And any other comments, Paulo, about double refractory disease?
No, in fact, double refractory, now probably we have to talk about triple refractory, meaning that pirtobrutinib is definitely entering the scene. And so we will use either before venetoclax or after venetoclax, but it will definitely be part probably of the standard treatment nowadays. So thinking that we can salvage the patient after the so-called triple refractory. I also share the enthusiasm, Jennifer's enthusiasm for BTK degraders and for bispecifics that look really like the promising drugs in the future. With Pirto in frontline, I mean, data is very impressive. I mean, 100% undetectable MRD, Pirto, venetoclax, obinutuzumab. Of course, we should really also collect data on what's next, meaning that we don't know what type of resistance really occurs after Pirto. Can we use the all the other BTK inhibitors after, or we lose the entire class of drugs? So that, those are the questions that probably we need to answer before we move Pirto to frontline.
So final comment from Jennifer. I feel like I'm talking to your breast cancer colleagues every day about estrogen receptor degraders. Now I'm starting to hear about androgen receptor degraders in prostate cancer. And lo and behold, here we have BTK inhibitor, BTK degraders. How do these agents work and how does it play out clinically in terms of risks and benefits, Jennifer?
Right. Well, so they have a multi-pronged molecule that binds to BTK on the one side and on the other side brings in a ubiquitin ligase and triggers the proteasome to degrade BTK. And Paolo was mentioning triple refractory. So there were a lot of triple refractory patients on these trials, phase one studies, at least double and some triple refractory. And we're seeing very nice response rates up on the order of 75%. Follow-up is still short, but I think the response rates and the fact that they're similar between two different molecules and two different trials are very encouraging, suggesting that this is real. And so that hopefully we'll get yet another line of BTK inhibitor therapy.
Paulo and Jennifer, thank you so much. I know we all learned so much tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great evening. Thanks so much, Jennifer. Thanks so much, Paulo.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
all.
you.